Urban Theology. Urban Theology. This is part two of December's Urban Theology. Urban Theology takes place once a month in the centre of Sydney at the St. James Hotel. It is a little oasis from the hustle and bustle of the increasingly secular city. Young 20-somethings, corporates and university students gather to either listen to an MC lead discussion or a debate on several topics that affect everyday Catholics. This month's topic was all about the wealth of the church. How much money does the church actually have? Where's it all coming from? And how is it being spent? Father Vincent Magat, a young Dominican priest who is the chaplain of Notre Dame University in Sydney, gave a thoughtful and interesting overview of this topic, leaving us with some answers and helping those who were searching. But first, here's your MC for the evening, Kai Chow.
Now, these are some of the more interesting... We've definitely got some interesting ones from a, I never knew that point of view question. So, okay, Father Vincent, we're back with you, and we want to know, okay, what are the main sources of revenue from the church? Where does all of the church's money come from?
You could look at it from the historical point of view or from what happens today.
Well, say today.
What happens to... Okay,
yeah, let's stick today. We've covered the churches.
I've just been cut off. Okay. These days, you will find in canon law, in the church's official law, that the church does actually have the right to ask for contributions from the faithful. So every single day, as you know, at every single Sunday especially, the church collects money from the faithful who turn up. And it is out of that, the money is then distributed from parishes to the bishop, through taxes to the bishop, and through taxes from that to the pope. On top of that, of course, there are other streams of revenue, so to speak. The church does provide certain services in which she receives at least some income, and the church does have, of course, investments in some things. One interesting case is the Sandhurst Diocese, which is, I think, the only diocese which has ever made a successful business deal, which owns most of the high street in Bendigo and receives an amazing income in rent from it, apparently. It's all held in a trust and everything else. Nobody will ever tell you how much money there is in it, but it does support the works of the church. On the other hand, of course, as I said before, especially with the Dominicans, there are all sorts of horrible deals that we have made, but I have a joke reserved for the Franciscans. You see, Dominicans, after their name, put OP, which stands for nothing else other than the Order of Preachers, or Ordo Predicatorum in Latin. But for the Franciscans, the OFM doesn't just stand for the Order of Fat Men. It also stands for Out for Money, as I've been told once. So beware the Franciscan who comes in with an invoice, as one of them came into Notre Dame today. Yeah.
Brother Dean, don't worry, we'll get you up here one day and revenge shall be yours. Okay, now, look, this is an interesting one. How did the church cope and fare with the recent global financial crisis? Gosh, this is the kind of story someone watching my channel would have come up with, but okay.
Well, the church, how did the church dealt with it? By losing a lot of money, just like everybody else did. So whatever investments the church had in shares and everything else, the church lost money on. Hopefully, not as much as some other people, because hopefully, as the practice from the little that one can say about my own experience, we do try to invest in responsible ways, not in ways that try to sort of ride the waves of success or failure, but try to go for the steady middle road. And so hopefully, as a result, the church hasn't lost as much money as everybody else has, but no doubt there would have been a net loss of the wealth that is at the disposal of the church.
Okay, now, who's the church's investment advisor? Is Macquarie Bank hiring these guys?
Every single parish and every single diocese, by canon law, is required to have a financial council on which must sit somebody who actually understands something about money.
So not Dominicans?
No. So from the grassroots all the way down, there is always people involved who hopefully do give sound and balanced advice. I did read somewhere that when the Vatican Bank was being audited for the first time in the ever, I think Price Cooper Waterhouse or whatever are they called?
PricewaterhouseCoopers.
Yeah, whatever. Yeah, we're called in as the auditors and advisors. So I'm sure the Vatican has its own people, so to speak. Yeah.
Okay. Now, okay, can you talk about why the chalice is so expensive and the altar and the tabernacle?
I have been dodging the question a little bit, and I was kindly reminded that this is something that must be spoken about. One thing that we do have to understand is, in one sense, what was the reason behind the fact that we do have all of these things in the first place. It wasn't that the church found herself somehow with all this money and decided to spend the money on herself, on the church's life and goodness, rather than on other things. The whole point is that so often people donate money to the church throughout its history, which I wanted to bring out, but anyway, exactly for the purpose of providing for something. Here is some money so that a priest can say mass for me. Here is some money so that a chalice can be bought. The point has always been that people give money to the church for particular reasons, to give glory to God, to bring some beautiful things into the world and find them in the church. So often it has been the case that even in the most poor areas of the world, beauty, genuine and real beauty, is to be found inside the churches. Not because someone else paid for it, so to speak, from the developed world, but because the very peasants, the very poor people around about, collected together to have something beautiful and to devote this thing to the glory of God. You do have to remember that St. Mary's Cathedral here was built by the pences and the little pennies of poor Irish immigrants. It wasn't built by huge donations from England or anywhere else. So often what the church has, she has because the poorest of the poor so often donated of the little that they had. After all, you always have to remember the scriptural passage of the poor widow dropping in the two coins. There is something genuinely real and genuinely religious, which of course is not to be found only in the Jewish faith, but in our faith as well.
Okay. Now, in today's society, wealth is often equated to power. Wealth is power, really. Do you think that the Catholic Church might be afraid to give up its wealth if it means that it's leading to a loss of its power?
I wonder what power exactly is that meant to be. I mean, in one sense, your wealth is power because you can dispose your wealth. You can buy things. You can do something with it. And people so often misunderstand the role of the church, the way that the church presides over its own wealth, its own resources. Just in the same way as the Pope cannot willy-nilly change the doctrines, so the Pope cannot willy-nilly dispose of the resources of the church. I think the more appropriate way to speak about the wealth of the church is not in terms of power, but in terms of capacity. The church certainly has capacity to do something with the money that it has. The less money the church would have, the less it could do. For instance, I think the right way for the church to use money is not simply to help the poor, which is all good and necessary, but also to enrich its own life and the life of its people. See, one of the things that perhaps I should have brought out a bit earlier, that one of the vices to do with charity, with giving, is that one gives so much that there is nothing left. I think in so many languages and so many cultures, there is almost a proverb about it, that if you give to 10 poor people, you become the 11th yourself. And something of that has to do with the wealth of the church as well. If the church was to give up everything that she had for the sake of the poor, not only would poverty not be solved, because it's not a money question, but at the same time, she would give up on her own future. There would be no way to educate the next generation of Catholics. There would be no way to provide for hospitals, for schools, for so many things which are essential to the life of the church. The world around us may very well be tempted to see us simply as a charity, as a very complicated charity. You know, every now and then on the St. Vincent de Paul bins, you will find this is the amount of money that was raised, and this is the percentage of the money that was spent on administration. And it's almost a shameful thing. They're almost saying, we're very sorry that we couldn't pass all your money over. There were some costs. I'm sorry. The church doesn't have to be apologetic for her own life. The church doesn't have to be apologetic for the fact that she has things which are beautiful, that she devotes a large part of her attention to worship, to education, to building up her own life. I think that is something that the world so often doesn't understand about us.
Okay. Now, is there any church building or icon that you would consider too opulent? I mean, you talk about the balance, for example, and I believe the person who's asked the question here has said, in the TV special Inside the Vatican, they showed they import flowers from Holland for certain events. Have we? Where have we crossed the line? Do we ever cross the line?
I think we quite often and very often do. Yes, unfortunately, we do. I'm not going to point out any particular things. I think that would be counterproductive, so to speak. One thing to notice, first of all, is when you talk about little things, you know, the flowers come from Holland, the Swiss guard comes from Switzerland.
You know, sometimes I look at those outfits and I think they come from another planet, but anyway.
One very interesting thing to notice, I mean, it so much happens in families as it happens anywhere else, that on, you know, on your particular birthday, we always go to this one restaurant. On yours, we do this. The same happens in the life of the church, even in the little parish level. You know, Mrs. So-and-so always does these things. And maybe there is an easier way to do it, but she contributes to the parish by washing the church linen in a very particular way and taking so much time and so much effort and everything else. And maybe in the whole scheme of things, it comes out as so much more expensive and from a certain point of view as so much more precious. Why is so much effort being wasted on this? And yet it is the way in which she contributes to the life of the church. And so when you get to the level of the papacy and the bishops and so on, so often there are these small particular traditions that things come from a particular place. That I do remember a story about something or another that the Pope wears has to be made from this particular fleece, from this particular place, from these particular sheep. No, it doesn't in the end, but it's a nice little tradition. It's a nice little thing to hold on to, so to speak, a nice little thing to practice for as long as people are willing to do it. And so often it comes out of the charity and the goodness of the people of God. If the Vatican, on the other hand, was to insist that everything must come from this place, so if the point of view is that the church demands that this be done, rather than the people of God coming freely and saying this is the things we want to do for the church, then the tables turn completely.
That's not happening? The church doesn't say no. Look, this is the Pope we're talking about. It's got to come from that particular fleece, from that particular sheep, or...
Sorry. No, I don't think that necessarily happens, though. I mean, one example, of course, is which caused a lot of upset in Australia was, when the Pope was coming as a sovereign of a state, he did require certain dignitaries to be made available by the state. And I think the budget for World Youth Day did run about six times over from the state's point of view for what it was meant to. So there are trappings, and there is a reason why we do call them trappings, because the humble and good message of God can get lost in these things.
You're saying that during World Youth Day that message was lost?
I think some of it was obscured, perhaps. That some of it was not necessarily for us, for the Catholics who joyfully and willingly participated in it, but for the world around us. So often what the good people of God saw was the joyful pilgrims and this and that. But at the same time, they did have to balance it against the things that they kept on hearing in the news. And just maybe, I don't know, I wasn't involved in the organization, so I cannot blame anyone else, just maybe perhaps there were some things that could have been handled better with more foresight and everything else. Mm. Yeah.
Okay. You talk about the reason why many things that appear opulent may be justified. Well, I mean, you say we do cross the line sometimes. Don't be specific to a particular event, but where are the danger areas? Where do we perhaps occasionally see the crossing of the line? Can you describe where those danger areas are?
Clerical fashion. Two words. I couldn't believe it in the end that when it came to my ordination, I did realize that there are different cuts of chasubles and that the fashion changes from time to time. And when it came to the point where my dear grandmother, out of the charity of her heart, had a couple chasubles made for me and they arrived and I didn't like them because they weren't what I wanted to wear, I started wondering exactly about that line and started feeling too much like a teenage girl, so to speak. But, you know, but Mom, I can't wear that. That's just not on right now. Yeah. Sorry, I taught at a girls' school for 6 months. This comes out every now and then. Yeah. So, yes, we do cross this line, unfortunately, every now and then. And again, the point is, if it does come from the good charity of the people of God, there is something to be said for it. And there is something to be said for the church accepting charity. But when it comes to the point of, well, I'm about to be ordained, so therefore everything must be made for me, we are about to cross the line.
Yeah. Okay. Now, we're going to... can you explain how the Pope demonstrates Christ-like humility adorned in all of that requisite finery as compared to, say, the Dalai Lama, who everyone in society, regardless of religion, views in a very different light when it comes to this whole humility issue, even though he's just as famous?
Humility, in one sense, I think is too often misunderstood as simply, if you are humble, you must be, so to speak, humble in everything, in all respects. As I tried to point out, I think just towards the end of when we were talking earlier, there is a way in which nobility and humility can work together, in which one can be humble, though being stately, in which one can be humble and yet at the same time be cultured, well-mannered, and for that matter, surrounded by at least some good things of life, so to speak. In the Pope's case also, it comes across in the wonderful wisdom that he brings to the world. I do think, without trying to be uncharitable towards Buddhism and towards Dalai Lama and such things, there is a line between the ever-smiling face of the Dalai Lama, who speaks in riddles and at times doesn't say very much, and the Pope in his stately majesty, one could say, who then produces an encyclical in which much wisdom is to be found. And I very much prefer one over the other, so to speak. And at the same time, one thing that did come out in... there was, of course, quite a number of reports these days made about the wealth of the Church and about the Vatican. We did mention the ballpark figure of the Vatican spending around $350 million a year on its budget. It also did say that the officials who work for the Vatican, this is both lay and especially the lay people, because clergy are paid in their own ways, the lay staff are paid much better than they are paid in Italy, just outside the borders of the Vatican. At the same time, though, the lifestyle of the Vatican, so to speak, is much more subdued than it is in so many other places, so many other royal courts that you could describe.
Okay. Now, just to finish, we've got a question which perhaps is maybe a little bit off topic, but I think we both thought it was an interesting one. Can you comment on the practice of selling papal blessings and Pope-blessed rosaries, and should these and similar items be up for sale? So now I'm fairly sure that the person who wrote this question isn't talking about simply just the cost recovery of making a rosary and just recovering that cost. I think they're saying, you know, when an object that you sell takes on an extra price tag component because it's got some kind of holy property to it.
I always do have to remind people that it doesn't matter who blesses something, whether it's the Pope or myself, it has the same power in the end, and it operates in the same way. One of the great lessons that we always learn in sacramental theology is that it doesn't belong to the worthiness of the priest, doesn't depend on the worthiness of the priest, whether the sacrament works. Because that way no one would ever celebrate a sacrament. Everybody would feel themselves too unworthy, the Pope included. The sale of all sorts of church material has always been a very complicated issue, and one could very much say that the Reformation was quite right on some parts of it. The Dominicans, I think, did benefit from selling quite some few indulgences. Thank you. It's certainly not a practice that one would want to revive in any way whatsoever. And the church piety stall can be done well, and it can be done badly. It can sell things which need to be sold because the cost of them needs to be recovered, or it can turn into a memorabilia shop. There is nothing special about the bat that Mr. Bradman played with and scored a century at the MCG with. In the end, it's just a piece of wood. There is something a bit more special about a rosary, but who blesses it, as you say, doesn't change anything about it. So in the end, I would be very much sympathetic to the point of view of saying no extra value is added by this, because one important thing that we do have to remember is, again, talking about the glory of the life of the Church, that though it does cost money to provide for vestments, candles, and all of these things, the whole point of it is that this money is, in the end, spent, used, and it is gone. I was reminded by someone just during the break that one marvelous example, of course, to use is something that would be very familiar to all of you. Sooner or later, unless you're entering religious life, hopefully you are looking forward to the day of your marriage or the day of your engagement. And sooner or later, no matter how devoted you are to the service of the poor and everything else, you are waiting for a ring to come, if you're a lady, to be given to you by the fellow, or if you're the young man, to spend quite a bit of money on this. And I was told just recently, it's, I think, 3 months worth of wages or something like that is the ritual, so to speak. It could be 4 months, it could be 2 months, whatever. The whole point is you spend all of this money on something that is essentially useless, on something that has no value, doesn't do anything, and yet if you didn't do it, something would be terribly amiss from life.
See, all the men right now are nodding, and all of the women here are just...
So my point in the end is that there are a lot of things that happen in the church which from the commercial point of view have absolutely no value. And that is exactly right, and that is exactly as it should be. Because you cannot put value on something like that, as you cannot put value on what happens within a family.
Okay, ladies and gentlemen, I'm sure you would agree that we've had some very frank and honest answers from Father here. I hope there are no juiceable manufacturers in the audience tonight who will be listening to Cradio later on, because I think we're going to be seeing that up on Cradio soon for those who couldn't be here or those who want to go back and have a re-listen. I would, of course, like you all to now join me in the usual manner of thanking Father Vincent for his talk.
Thanks for listening to Urban Theology. If you want to know more about Urban Theology or more about Cradio, go to our website, cradio.org.au.